I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Stroke remains one of the leading causes of death and disability in the United States. New advances in the rapid detection and treatment of strokes has definitely improved survival. But with improvements in survival, the need for advancing rehabilitation of stroke has become even more important. Tonight on Health Matters, we will discuss topics of stroke as well as neurological rehabilitation following brain injuries and stroke. As you know, Health Matters is a live weekly show here on Red River Radio where we invite you, our listeners, to join this discussion, and you can call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have two excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Ali Menegar, with Professor and Chairman of Neurology here at LSU MC in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Suzanne Tinsley, Assistant Professor, Department of Rehabilitation Sciences, and Program Director of the School of Allied Health, Family Practice Clinic Neurological Rehabilitation Program here, as well at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. As you know, Health Matters is a live show, and again, the number for your calls for questions or concerns, it is 1-800-552-8502, and the Twitter account is at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Menegar, thank you so much for joining us again here on Health Matters on Red River Radio. To get started, I know you've seen stroke a lot, and many of our listeners may have heard of what a stroke is, but from the neurologist's perspective, when you think about what's happening during the brain during a stroke, could you describe that for us a little bit?
Yes. First, thank you for inviting me, and good evening to all listeners. By definition, a stroke, we're talking here about the ischemic stroke, which is the most common form of a stroke in clinical practice, is defined by sudden interruption of the blood flow and the nutrients to certain areas of the brain. And this potentially has devastating effect on the neurons and other cells within the central nervous system, and clinically manifests with sudden neurological deficits and problems such as loss of ability to speak, weakness, falls, sensory abnormalities, ataxia, and a number of their symptoms. Stroke is an emergency, and it can kill the patient or can leave the patient with permanent and devastating neurological problem. It is very important that public become more and more familiar with the stroke and the fact that these patients need to be rushed to the nearest emergency room for acute treatment of the stroke.
That was Dr. Ali Menegar, Professor and Chairman, Department of Neurology here at LSU in Shreveport, describing what the symptoms of a stroke are, and a stroke is an emergency. Just like there is a thing known as a heart attack, a stroke is indeed a brain attack, and this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. You can call with questions about stroke or neurological rehabilitation at 1-800-552-8502. And to talk about neurological rehabilitation with us, we have Dr. Suzanne Tinsley. Dr. Tinsley, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. I appreciate the opportunity.
So when someone has a stroke or some sort of a brain injury, when does the process of healing actually begin from your standpoint as an expert in physical therapy?
Well, from our standpoint, what we would like, certainly rehabilitation needs to begin whenever that patient is medically stable. So when Dr. Menegar and his group states that the patient from a medical standpoint is stable, then from a rehab standpoint, we would like to go ahead and get started with our intervention. So certainly within 24 to 48 hours, once they've been stabilized, then we need to go in. A lot of the impairments that we see for patients that have stroke, many of them can be prevented with the appropriate intervention at the appropriate time. And so certainly we're not talking about 4 or 5 hours of therapy a day, but certainly going in and working on positioning, getting that patient up, trying to prevent swelling, trying to prevent the effects of flaccidity when they've had a stroke, then the muscles on a particular side of the body are not functioning, and so then there's mechanical things that can go wrong. So early on, we're really trying to prevent secondary complications and then starting that process of rehab, which is verticality, getting the patient up, etc.
So the process of rehabilitation takes really place in what we would consider the acute phase. The patient is actually still in the hospital, maybe receiving acute therapy, and it's important to go ahead and think about what this future for this patient's going to look like.
Oh, absolutely. For those of us like myself that are in an outpatient environment, certainly when I get patients that are 3, 4, 5 weeks after, or 3, 4, 5 months, year post-stroke, certainly from my standpoint, I can tell when that patient had good, appropriate acute care in terms of therapy based on the lack of impairments or secondary complications. For example, there's this phenomenon called spasticity that often occurs. Though that is a primary effect of the stroke, some of the problems that we see with spasticity, like joint contractures or shortening of muscles or lack of range of motion, that doesn't occur primary to the stroke. That occurs as a secondary event, and those things can be prevented with the appropriate input.
And so, absolutely, stroke is something that is extremely common. Physical therapy is going to be very important in starting the patient down that pathway to getting better right away. Dr. Menegar, when you think about what the most important transformation has been in the treatment of stroke during your lifetime, what would that be?
Perhaps the most important and prominent transformation in the world of treatment of a stroke, especially ischemic stroke, is development of TPA, which is also known as the clot buster. Based on clinical trials that have been done in the United States and many other countries, we know that if we can catch these patients within 3 hours window of opportunity and we infuse them with the clot buster intravenously, there is a potential chance for that occluded vessel to open up and the areas of the brain and the spinal cord, if it's involved, that basically do not receive enough blood can be basically supplied with blood. So development of TPA or the clot buster is the most important clinical aspect of this process. In addition to that, from every aspect we look at the stroke management compared to decades ago, we have significantly improved. More and more physicians are familiar or are becoming familiar with the symptoms and signs of a stroke and how to intervene in a timely manner and how to manage these patients in the inpatient setting or in the outpatient clinics. Also, the other important development is we are now more aware of the risk factors, the common risk factors for a stroke, and how to address them, how to prevent them, how to rectify them to make sure that the risk of a stroke is basically coming down.
Very good. We have our first caller of the evening. We have Walter from Marshall. Walter, thank you so much for calling us tonight.
Okay. My mother told me that all pineapple, if they can, it ruins enzymes, and it will help disrupt the clots.
What sort of enzymes are you talking about?
In the raw pineapple.
Raw pineapple.
Yep.
All right. Well, Dr. Menegar, have you heard of anything along the lines of enzymes in raw pineapple that can help with maybe stroke modifying risk factors?
Well, I'm not aware of such a thing. However, I will definitely look into literature to explore this possibility, but I'm not personally aware of this substance.
I've got one more question.
Yes, sir. Go ahead,
it's
please.
Not on that subject, but your brain's analog and your computers are digital. Is there anybody working on a interface? You know, you've got two ways you can change your analog to digital, digital to analog, so you can communicate with your computer and back.
Walter, thank you so much. That certainly is a very technical question. Dr. Tinsley, you do a lot in terms of technical advances in recovery following stroke and brain injuries. The interface between computers and the brain.
Just from some little bit of literature I've read, and certainly there is some idea that there are magnetic fields that the brain puts off, and we have a scientist at the School of Allied Health, Dr. Cliff Freelow, that is doing some work along those lines, looking at the magnetic imagery and how, looking at people with sleep apnea, looking at people, children that have autism, trying to look at how the brain functions. There is the idea that then, based on those magnetic fields, that there could possibly be some way that you could communicate or think and then have that projected to a computer. But in the area of stroke rehab, it's primarily then that connection from the brain that is being damaged that can no longer affect or control the muscle. And so there are technologies that are available called the neuroprosthesis, that basically what happens when you've had an upper motor neuron injury, like a stroke or a brain injury, the peripheral muscle and nerve still works. Unfortunately, the major neuron in the brain that controls that is not there. So there are some devices, and we have several of those within our faculty practice clinic, that will then allow those muscles of the extremity, the arm and the hand, to function in the absence of the brain activating it. We can activate it from an external device, a type of functional electrical stim unit. In the sense of that interface, again, we have to think about in stroke, the brain function has been lost. And certainly there's this concept of neuroplasticity and the ability of the brain to reorganize. And so the idea then is maybe an outside computer. If that doesn't occur and that brain function can't return, then we do have technology that will allow an outside or an external device to fire the muscle to be able to do functional components.
Dr. Menegar, any comments you might have regarding the brain computer interface and what you're seeing with current stroke therapy?
What I can say is I'm aware of certain programs that are developed for patients with basically deficits originating from acute strokes to assist them to reorganize basically and recapture the functions that they have lost. Some of these programs are at the level of experimentation, and some of them are being used at certain rehabilitation centers. As Dr. Tinsley mentioned, they are using it. So in certain ways, these programs are very helpful in order to help these individuals to rehabilitate their brain and restore the lost function, whether it's a mechanical function or an intellectual function. We always encourage our patients to use those programs.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the technological advances are very, very quick as compared to medical advances, and it's certainly a big challenge in terms of dealing with the brain. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. We invite you to call if you have a question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. You know, one of my favorite shows on public radio is the TED Radio Hour, Technology, Entertainment, Design. And a neuroscientist, Jill Bolt Taylor, actually suffered her own version of a stroke. And we're going to listen to that segment right now.
I woke up to a pounding pain behind my left eye. And it was the kind of pain, caustic pain, that you get when you bite into ice cream. And it just gripped me, and then it released me. And then it just gripped me, and then it released me. And it was very unusual for me to ever experience any kind of pain, so I thought, okay, I'll just start my normal routine. So I got up and I jumped onto my CardioGlider, which is a full body, full exercise machine. And I'm jamming away on this thing, and I'm realizing that my hands look like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I thought, that's very peculiar. And I looked down at my body and I thought, whoa, I am a weird looking thing. And it was as though my consciousness had shifted away from my normal perception of reality, where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric space where I'm witnessing myself having this experience. And it was all very peculiar, and my headache was just getting worse. So I get off the machine And I'm walking across my living room floor, and I realize that everything inside of my body has slowed way down. And every step is very rigid and very deliberate. There's no fluidity to my pace, and there's this constriction in my area of perception, so I'm just focused on internal systems. And I'm standing in my bathroom getting ready to step into the shower, and I could actually hear the dialogue inside of my body. I heard a little voice saying, okay, you muscles, you got to contract, and you muscles, you relax. And then I lost my balance, and I'm propped up against the wall. And I look down at my arm, and I realize that I can no longer define the boundaries of my body. I can't define where I begin and where I end, because the atoms and the molecules of my arm blended with the atoms and molecules of the wall. And all I could detect was this energy. And I'm asking myself, what is wrong with me? What is going on? And in that moment, my left hemisphere brain chatter went totally silent. Just like someone took a remote control and pushed the mute button. Total silence. And at first I was shocked to find myself inside of a silent mind. But then I was immediately captivated by the magnificence of the energy around me. And because I could no longer identify the boundaries of my body, I felt enormous and expansive. I felt at one with all the energy that was, and it was beautiful there. And then all of a sudden, my left hemisphere comes back online, and it says to me, hey, we got a problem. We got to get some help. And I'm going, oh, I got a problem. So it's like, okay, I got a problem. But then I immediately drifted right back out into the consciousness, and I affectionately refer to this space as La La Land.
That was Jill Bolt Taylor, a neuroscientist, and her full TED Talk can be heard at TED.com. We're going to go ahead and take our next caller. We have Mary from Shreveport. Mary, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me ask a question. I have two questions, probably for Dr. Tinsley. Dr. Tinsley, can you describe the program that you use to rehab a stroke patient and what makes your program different from others in the area, or are there any other programs in the area?
Sure. Thanks, Mary. Our program at LSU, I can speak for it directly. We basically practice what is considered evidence-based practice in terms of neurological rehab or rehab for patients that have had a stroke. Certainly, there's been a great paradigm shift over the last 10 to 15 years in how we think about patients who've had a neurological deficit like a stroke and what their recovery could be. And what the evidence tells us is that the brain has the ability to reorganize, and it's a phenomenon or concept called neuroplasticity. And what the evidence tells us is for that to occur, there has to be consistent, repetitive sensory input to stimulate that brain to do that. And so the paradigm shift, or what we try to employ in our clinic, is then to try to think about how we could get that process to occur. So things like the old paradigm shift was the idea of you had therapy an hour a day or an hour a day, 3 days a week. And now we recognize that that's just not enough, that the evidence tells us that there has to be consistent, repetitive activity. And so we try to organize our program around that. So we have a lot of the technology that is available to us to provide that input that's going to allow that brain to reorganize and to recover. And the idea that what the evidence tells us is that if you want to learn to walk, then you need to walk. And so early on, that might be quite difficult if we've got a patient that doesn't have any control or very little control of the left side of their body. So then we have that technology available, like the vector system or the body weight support system, to where we can get patients up early and do those activities. It's called task-specific activities. I'm not really aware, you know, again, of what is available in other facilities in our area, but I will tell you that's what we have. And we have four therapists that are specialized in neuro rehab, and so that's all that we do. And so, again, I can just say that we practice what is considered evidence-based practice in the area, and those are just a few examples. So I hope that answered your question.
Mary, thank you so much for calling. This is listener-supported Red River Radio's local show, locally produced here, and it's Health Matters. Our topic tonight is neurological rehabilitation and stroke. You can call and ask a question at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Menegar, Chairman of the Department of Neurology here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Suzanne Tinsley with the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences here in Shreveport. These are our guests tonight. Dr. Menegar, we have a question that was submitted online, and it's asking about what is endovascular therapy for stroke? And I know you talked a little bit about TPA. So what does endovascular actually mean, and how does that apply to the acute therapy for stroke?
Well, this is an excellent question, because endovascular therapy of a stroke is a very hot topic these days, and pretty much every stroke center in the United States does have an interventional radiologist or a neurosurgeon or a vascular surgeon who probably is involved in endovascular treatment of a stroke. This means that if a patient is not a candidate for the basically clot buster, the TPA, and if they come to the medical center, to the emergency room, at a window of opportunities, when the window of opportunities is still open, we can urgently call an interventionalist with their devices. Basically, these devices are clot retriever. They go into the vascular system of these individuals and try to mechanically remove the blood clot. In many cases, this can be a success story, and they are able to restore the circulation to those areas of the brain which are affected. So in cases that the TPA doesn't work, or the patient is not a candidate for TPA, does not meet the criteria to give the clotbuster TPA, we call our interventionalist to use their tools to retrieve the blood clot. And indeed, this endovascular treatment of a stroke area has made a significant change in the treatment of these patients. And we are very fortunate that at LSU Health Sciences Center, we do have this personnel, we do have these physicians who are always available for us to assist our patients.
So that is endovascular therapy. And so you're talking about clot retrieval devices. Now, is the device actually dissolving the clot, or is it pulling the clot out of the patient?
They usually pull it mechanically out of the vessel.
And so the patient may be a patient who has gotten TPA already intravenously, which is systemic TPA, may not have responded. And so they're not going to actually infuse TPA into the brain through this device. It's actually going to pull the clot out.
That's correct.
It's very, very interesting therapy. Dr. Tinsley, have you seen the rehabilitation climate change since the advent of these more aggressive approaches to dissolving clots and pulling clots out?
Oh, absolutely. I think from my standpoint, what we like to see is when a patient then has recognized that stroke, received the appropriate medical treatment. So what we see on our rehab side is that maybe that their deficits are not quite as severe. So certainly as a team that we work together, it's very exciting that we are constantly trying to educate our patients on the risk of stroke, because the sooner that they can get intervention, then hopefully the less damage they'll have to their brain, and so then it makes our job on the rehab side much, much better. And so certainly we still have those patients that have those dense strokes, complete hemiplegias, where they've lost all use of the upper extremity and the lower extremity on one side. But certainly we can see some patients then that have gotten the appropriate treatment then are not quite as severely disabled, and so then it makes rehab much, much easier.
Does it tend to shift the rehab more towards the cognitive side and less so from the physical standpoint when you have more minor deficits?
Well, Dr. Brewer, it really depends on what area of the brain is affected, what artery, where was the clot, where did that clot lodge? So again, that's not really important in terms of the intervention that Dr. Menegar talked about, that idea of whether it's upper extremity or lower extremity affected, or whether they have cognitive or visual deficits, that's dependent on where the clot is in the brain and what artery is affected.
Very good. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight on Health Matters is stroke and neurological rehabilitation. The number for your calls, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Menegar, we listened to the clip from the TED Talk of Dr. Taylor, and she actually had a hemorrhagic stroke. I don't know if you heard that talk or not, but she had what's called, I believe it was either an aneurysm or an arteriovenous malformation, rupture in the brain. But how would you compare her description of her stroke to what you see in clinical practice?
Well, in this case, the patient is a highly educated individual who does have basically a very basic knowledge and in-depth knowledge of the signs and symptoms of a stroke, in this case, hemorrhagic stroke. And usually patients who present with hemorrhagic stroke, which means that they have bled intracranially, and then also there are different forms of hemorrhagic strokes. For example, in this case, patient bled from an aneurysm. Suddenly aneurysm ruptured, and she basically developed neurological symptoms. Usually these patients present with sudden onset headache, and what they say characteristically is that I am experiencing the worst headache of my life. And this can be followed with loss of consciousness, seizures, or fluctuation of consciousness, as she was mentioning in her description that she could recognize the boundary of her body, then she could not recognize it. She was going in and out of consciousness and drifting into unconsciousness, actually. And this is a very eloquent, very well-adapted description of the clinical symptoms. 20% of all strokes fall under bleeding or hemorrhagic strokes, and 80% under ischemic stroke. And hemorrhagic strokes are devastating as well. They can be lethal. And if we get to these patients in a timely way, there may be ways to help them. We always call neurosurgeons and vascular surgeons to our help, plus other systems and services such as medicine and neurology, to be involved in the management of these patients. Usually these patients are emergency cases, and the time that we get into them is of vital importance. The faster we get to these patients, the faster they're brought to the medical attention, to the emergency rooms, the better outcome may be out there versus getting to these patients late. That can be lethal. So by itself, it's a huge category of devastating neurological emergencies. And fortunately, at LSU Health Sciences Center, we do have very well-equipped and very well-experienced services to help these individuals and treat them.
And obviously, with Dr. Tinsley's expertise, we have excellent rehabilitation services at LSU as well. You know, Dr. Menegar, as we know, the brain itself doesn't experience pain. You can operate on the brain, and the patient doesn't have a significant pain response. And so when the neuroscientist was talking about her headache during her stroke, does this mean something to you in terms of the etiology of the cause of her stroke?
That's actually a very good point. That's true. Brain itself does not feel the pain, but the membranes around the brain and certain structures within the human cranium do have pain receptors. And when you introduce a new substance to the very closed environment of the intracranial space, which has only space for the brain tissue and cerebrospinal fluid, suddenly you infuse a huge volume of blood. That causes extension and a stretching of those membranes and structures that are pain sensitive. As a result, the patient experiences severe intractable, to the level they say it's exploding headache, which that actually is the factor that brings a lot of these patients to medical attention, because they have never experienced anything of this magnitude within their head. So those structures which are sensitive to pain and do have pain receptors, when they're stretched, when they're in contact with blood and chemicals within the blood, they become irritated, and this is the way they are telling the patient that something bad is happening and you need to seek medical attention.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight on Health Matters is stroke and neurorehabilitation. We're going to go ahead and take our next caller, but if you want to be the caller after that, the number for your call is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Let's go ahead and talk to Walter from Shreveport. Walter, thanks for calling.
Thanks, sir. The government has a list of resonant frequencies. The resonant frequencies can give you healthy organs or sick ones. And could you take the resonant frequency of the sick one and bring it back to the resonant frequency of the well one, and thereby reduce the stroke? Is there anybody doing anything like that?
That's a good question. Thank you for that question, Walter. Dr. Tinsley, do you know anything about resonant frequencies of health versus disease or stroke? It's not something that I've encountered personally in my medical career.
No, sir, nor have I. Dr. Menegar, I'm not familiar with any.
I'm not familiar either.
Again, let's, Dr. Menegar, you were talking about strokes. They can be ischemic, which means not enough blood in the brain, and then hemorrhagic, which means there's too much blood in the brain, right? So 80% of strokes are ischemic. What are the risk factors for the most common strokes that you see?
Okay, the risk factors for basically ischemic stroke are very similar to those risk factors for heart attack. Basically, high blood pressure, which also known as hypertension, diabetes mellitus, obesity, lack of physical activity, hypercholesterolemia, abnormalities of cholesterol or triglyceride levels, using illicit drugs, particularly using something like cocaine. These are common risk factors in our society, and a majority of them can be modified and can be corrected. Of course, there are certain risk factors that cannot be modified, such as age and gender. For example, we know that in basically strokes are more common in males, they're more common after age 65. Also, certain races, such as African Americans, may have a higher tendency to have strokes. So those risk factors cannot be modified. But the other ones, such as high blood pressure or diabetes or a lack of physical activity or sedentary lifestyle, smoking especially, can be modified and can be corrected. And that question leads to this issue that we always tell all of our patients, please watch your weight, watch your diet, and exercise, daily exercise, or even 3 times weekly exercise can help to reduce the risk of ischemic heart disease and ischemic brain disease. So these are the messages we send to our patients whenever we have the opportunity and see them.
So just like many other things that we talk about on this show, taking good care of yourself is going to reduce your risk as much as you can in terms of stroke. One thing that I think is important to mention might be genetic factors. Do you see that genetic risk factors occur as well in certain types of strokes?
That's a very good question. The answer is yes. There are certain genetic diseases which are uncommon, and once or twice a year we see these individuals who present with the strokes at a young age, for example at age 15 to 45, or with very unique forms of a stroke that you don't see them commonly in population which you see your patients in. For example, there are certain abnormalities that can increase the chance of clot formation in the body, and these hypercoagulable syndromes can be associated with the increased tendency to develop blood clots which is abnormal in many of these cases, and some of these blood clots may get clogged within the cerebral brain circulation and can cause a stroke or can cause heart attack. Or these patients may develop blood clots in their legs. This will travel to their lungs or to their heart, causes pulmonary embolism or heart attack or brain attack. And also there are other forms of genetic diseases that can cause frequent strokes. One of the most famous one is CADASIL, which is associated with frequent ischemic stroke and progressive dementia and headaches at a young age. And when you talk to these individuals, they mention that they have other family members or they had other people who have passed away, but they experienced strokes at a younger age. So any time that we look at a patient with a stroke that does not fall within those basically common and traditional patients that we see with known risk factors, we think about the genetic factors.
Okay, so stroke in the young, certain proteins in the blood that make the blood too thick if they've had history of blood clots, maybe history of clots while they're on oral contraceptives, things along those lines would be important to recognize.
Yes, sir. They're all important issues that need to be explored.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic tonight on Health Matters is stroke and neurological rehabilitation. Also with us tonight, Dr. Suzanne Tinsley. And Dr. Tinsley, when we talk about physical rehabilitation, you mentioned the terms task-specific strategies, looking at things like frequency, duration, and intensity of therapy, and so-called whole client interventions. Can you talk to us a little bit about what those terms mean?
Sure. The idea, again, when we talk about what we've learned over the last 10 to 15 years about how the brain reorganizes, certainly when we think about someone who's had a stroke, that's what we would call a non-degenerative or a non-progressive disease or injury. If someone has something like Parkinson's disease or multiple sclerosis, those are degenerative in nature, meaning that they're going to continue to progress. Someone that has had a stroke, it's usually a one-time event. The stroke itself is not going to grow over time. And so with that, then, we have this idea that these patients then can have the ability for their brain to reorganize and to relearn. And so part of that idea, say 15 or 20 years ago when someone had a stroke, we treated them with what they had left after that stroke was there. So if they weren't able to use their right side, then we taught them how to compensate with their left side. But we now know that because it is a non-progressive process, then that there is the ability to learn or to reorganize. So that idea of task-specific strategies. If you want to learn to walk, you need to walk. So this idea of doing rehab, stroke rehab or neuro rehab by laying on a mat and doing exercises, there's nothing that we really do laying on a mat and doing exercise. So certainly those are things that we do a little bit, but the idea is that we really need to ask the patient, what are those things that you want to do? And then we need to train the brain to recover that. So that's what we mean by task-specific. So, you know, we could come up with 5 or 10 really functional tasks across the board that everybody wants to do, things like being able to walk, being able to get out of bed, climb stairs. But certainly we also know that the brain is going to do better when the person is engaged in that activity. So I might have an individual that has poor balance, and we could working on balance, but the fact that the young man or the gentleman has said, you know what, I'd really like to play golf again, then, you know, I'm going to get a golf club in his hand and stand behind him with the gait belt and let him practice swinging that club, even if I have to wrap the golf club around his hand, because then that's going to make him shift his weight. That's going to work on his balance, but it's doing something that's very task-specific and important to him. And what the literature tells us then is that that's going to help the brain recover faster. Also, that idea of frequency. Certainly, again, we know that that's not going to occur. If you think about, Dr. Brewer, when you were learning as a kid how to do something, say shoot a free throw, you practiced it over and over and over again. And so for that brain to recover that function, to reacquire that, then it has to practice many times. And so we really have to think about now how we're going to do rehab within the confinements of what insurance and Medicare will allow versus then what we know. So trying to tweak that system in terms of How often do we do it? What each day or each week, how much do we do? Also the intensity. We want to push patients to the limit. So, you know, I have patients say, you know, Dr. Tinsley, whenever I tell you I can do something or something comes easy, you're always making me do something harder. And so that's, again, that idea of intensity. Certainly the whole client, Dr. Menegar, talked about how blood pressure and lack of activity or exercise or sedentary lifestyles are a problem. Again, we want to treat the whole client. And so, and that's a major issue with patients that have had a stroke, is that they do become less active. And so we have to figure out how we can get them active and moving so that way we can prevent another incidence down the road. So again, looking at the client as a whole.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. Our topic on Health Matters tonight is stroke and neurological rehabilitation. We have two excellent guests with us tonight with expertise in both areas. We have Dr. Ali Menegar, Chairman of the Department of Neurology here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Suzanne Tinsley, Associate Professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences. Dr. Menegar, Richard from Lufton has submitted a question to us. And he would like to know if there's a relationship between alcohol and stroke. And so we talk about alcohol. Maybe red wine drinkers may have a lower risk of heart attacks. Do we know anything about stroke?
Well, it is also, the alcoholism is also considered a risk factor for a stroke because alcohol by itself is a neurotoxic agent. And in the course of time, consumption of large amount of alcohol that falls under the definition of alcoholism can affect and accelerate the process of atherosclerosis of the blood vessels, can cause significant loss of neurons, and can increase the chance of basically having heart attack or brain attack. So we always talk to our patients, ask them this particular question, do you consume alcohol? And if we feel that by definition and by clinical evidence they are alcoholic, we strongly suggest them to stop doing so, and we try to offer them proper treatment and refer them to proper centers to help them to basically recover from alcoholism. So this is actually a very important and a very big question. And I'm appreciating this listener by asking this question, because alcoholism is a significant health matter and definitely plays a role in development of a stroke.
And certainly then, from my standpoint, after we're starting rehab here, we have a brain that we're trying to get active and we're trying to wake up and function. And alcohol is a sedative. And so, you know, I'm constantly talking to my patients about, maybe we ought to think about not doing that while we're, you know, we're trying to get your brain to recover and wake up and function. And then you're putting something in there that's going to sedate it.
So in terms of alcohol in moderation, is there any data that would suggest it has any benefits in stroke prevention, either primary or secondary?
There is no significant data to show that consumption of any amount of alcohol can, in the long run, prevent the development of a stroke.
Thank you so much for that answer. We have Tanya from Shreveport. Tanya, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Hi. My question is, one, at what point are you physical rehab interested in starting therapy with the client after an episode? And the second part of the question is pertaining to within the confinements of Medicare and insurance, how aggressive are we with families teaching them to help their loved one swing the golf putter or throw the softball or whatever it is that engages them into recovery of those tasks that they want to do more. That would be all.
Okay, thank you, Tanya, for calling.
Okay.
I guess that would be for me. Tanya, the idea about starting rehab, well, certainly it is quite difficult now with the paradigm shift for what we know from the literature or for what the research tells us. So we certainly, there is a problem then. The idea that the one thing that I hate is that insurance companies have this idea of, you know, well, we're going to pay for rehab for 6 months after You've had a stroke, and then after that, we're gonna, you know, they'll say, well, we may or may not cover it. Well, the idea is that the brain, really, in 6 months after it's had a devastating event like this, is just really beginning to settle down. And so that old adage of what you've gotten return is all you're going to get within the year, you know, that is erroneous. That is not true. The brain has the capacity to learn and reorganize way past that year component. So I certainly think that there's going to have to be a shift for clinics like ours, working with physicians like Dr. Menegar, to change that idea that all you're going to get back is what you're going to get back within a year. That is erroneous. That is not true. So we would like to start therapy as soon as possible, but also to recognize if you've been out, say, a year or 2 years, that there still might be the ability to get better with the appropriate and the right type of intervention. So we would like therapy to begin as soon as possible, but if you didn't have that opportunity, certainly there is no reason to think that a year and a half, 2 years post-stroke, that you couldn't get some return if you came back and engaged in a program. And certainly we're doing quite a bit of research within our clinic, and we're actually showing that. Also, certainly, again, you need to practice, and so we try to get within our program at our faculty practice clinic, we try to get family members involved as much as possible as to what they need to do at home, what they need to help with, certainly as that family is willing to do that, and certainly as that family is capable of doing that. So you're absolutely correct. I mean, there has to be more practice than what we do in the confines of the physical therapy treatment time. And so we're certainly trying to work with families to do those types of things.
Tanya, those were two excellent questions. Thank you so much for calling. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The topic tonight is stroke and neurological rehabilitation. Our guests tonight, Dr. Suzanne Tinsley and Dr. Ali Menegar, experts from Louisiana State University School of Medicine here in Shreveport in both stroke and neurological rehabilitation. Dr. Menegar, Dennis from Leesville has submitted a question online, and what he would like to know is it possible to have a stroke and not know it? So we talk about silent heart attacks. Are there such things as silent strokes?
This is an excellent question. The answer, unfortunately, is yes. And it's very common that we see patients in our neurology clinic for unrelated diseases such as migraine or other neurological problems that has nothing to do with the stroke. And then when we obtain MRI of their brain for other reasons, we see certain lesions in certain areas of the brain that may not produce clinical symptoms of enough severity and significance to interfere with the patient's daily living activities. So they may be interpreted as silent stroke lesion or silent ischemic stroke lesions. And when you talk to these individuals and look at their lifestyle, in many cases, you may be able to detect certain risk factors such as uncontrolled hypertension, obesity, smoking, uncontrolled diabetes mellitus, or alcoholism. So we always look at these factors, especially when these images are brought to our attention that the radiologist or any other physician asks what these lesions are, or they report them as ischemic lesions. They are tiny, and each one of them by itself may not produce clinical symptoms, but when they collect over the course of years, they become a problem, and they produce and they hit the patient hard eventually. And also, when these lesions happen, what is their significance? The significance is the patient does have potential risk factors, and if those modifiable risk factors are not modified or not revised and corrected, the patient may end up with a massive ischemic or hemorrhagic stroke. So this is the significance of those basically lesions that are interpreted as silent stroke lesions. So this is a very good point that this listener brought up, and I appreciate him.
Yeah, so the so-called small vessel diseases that, you know, diabetes, uncontrolled hypertension, not only lead to big strokes, but lead to these little strokes. And, you know, we learn about this condition that can look a lot like Alzheimer's disease called multi-infarct dementia, right? And so some of these people have been having very small strokes for many, many years. And they may look like they have Alzheimer's. They may even look like they have Parkinson's disease. But in fact, it was the poorly controlled hypertension or the poorly controlled diabetes for many, many years that caused these conditions that look like basically a neurodegenerative disease.
That's an excellent point.
We have Clyde from Nacogdoches, Texas. Clyde, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Well, what can you tell us about TIAs?
Dr. Menegar, what can you tell us about TIAs?
Okay, I'm very glad he brought up this question. This is another important topic. TIA means transient ischemic attack, means that an area or certain areas of the brain have not received or have been deprived of the blood and nutrients that they're supposed to receive. And this temporary, basically cutoff of the blood, can cause transient neurological symptoms. By definition, a TIA should last less than 24 hours, but practically they last much shorter, less than 24 seconds or even 24 minutes or 24 seconds. So means that the patient develops a neurological deficit that is short-lasting, less than 24 hours, and it usually resolves on its own. But TIA can be a stroke by itself. And the significance of the TIA is that if you experience TIA, such as half of the body goes numb for a few seconds and the patient recovers, or goes weak and the patient automatically, spontaneously recovers, it means this individual is at a high risk for developing a massive, devastating stroke. So if you have a patient, or if you see a family member whose speech is slurred and then it becomes normal and this is of sudden onset, or they have difficulty with walking and they have lack of balance, or their face is crooked, or they have developed weakness of sudden onset and then it resolves, it means this individual is at high risk for developing an acute stroke. And the family members or the people who are with this individual should call 911 or take the patient to the nearest emergency room for medical evaluation, for neurological evaluation. Please bear in mind that when you have someone with TIA, your rapid intervention, your recognition of these symptoms, these short-lasting symptoms that may resolve spontaneously, can save someone's life or can save that patient from having a life of neurological deficits and limitations that are imposed upon him or her by that devastating stroke. We are pushing this idea that please pay attention to the TIA or transient neurological deficits. Please be aware of them. If you see them, similar to someone who has chest pain, every chest pain, you should take it absolutely seriously until proven otherwise, because when you take it seriously, then you may be able to save somebody's life. So in this case also, you can restore someone's life, you can save them from a life of pain and agony that are imposed upon them by the limitations that are going to be caused by an upcoming stroke. And basically with proper medical management and intervention, they can be helped.
Yeah, that, you know, I think if I were going to design the brain again, I would probably make it sense pain. You know, since the heart is pretty good at letting us know when it's ischemic, you know, the brain doesn't do nearly as good of a job. Dr. Tinsley, you know, we were talking about technological advances in stroke rehabilitation and other rehabilitation strategies. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with your research and what is coming ahead in terms of robotics and some of the other technological advances in the last couple of minutes that we have?
Sure. With our program at the Faculty Practice Clinic there at LSU Health, we recognize that the future of neurorehab is technology. Again, if we think about how the brain functions and how we're going to have that brain reorganize and relearn and recover, it's this idea there has to be consistent sensory stimulus. And so there are many devices out, like the Bioness neuroprosthetic system for the upper and lower extremity, that will allow the muscles to contract so that we can get those patients up and walk, and then that input, that activity, will help organize the brain. Also, we're very fortunate that we have the Vector system, which is an overground trolley system for gait and safety, where we can get patients up that it used to take four or five of us. We can get them up and start standing and walking. And then we certainly some of the integrated therapy systems, where we're using computers to work on spatial orientation and neglect and driving and spatial relationships. I mean, that's where rehab is, and we're very fortunate in that we have those many of those pieces of equipment. Now, again, it's not the equipment, it's the therapists that are driving that, but that idea that we have that equipment available for us. Again, it's not the equipment, it's the therapists that are then using that to provide that rehab, and it's very exciting that what we have available, not only for our patients but also for our students, so that they can see this in action, so that maybe then when they go out, then you know we can propagate that change.
And it's really that hands-on treatment that the therapists and the physical therapy assistants and the students really provide to the patients. And I don't think. You know, I don't think physical therapists are going to be replaced by robots anytime soon, do you?
Oh, no, sir, not at all. I hope
think
not.
That personal relationship is so important.
Absolutely.
I see that with, you know, patients all the time, you know, that encouragement, you know, getting to know those task-specific things that are so important to the patients that, you know, means so much, I think, to these people, because they, like Dr. Menegar has mentioned, they may have been devastated or nearly devastated by an event, and you know, developing those close personal ties while you're also using the latest in technological advances probably makes a really big difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I would like to thank Dr. Suzanne Tinsley, Associate Professor of Rehabilitation Sciences here at LSU School of Medicine in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Ali Menegar, Professor and Chairman in the Department of Neurology, for joining us tonight for Health Matters. And I'd like to thank our callers for calling in and asking some really, really good questions tonight. As you know, Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult your physician or your healthcare provider for all health concerns. Guests on Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation in Health Matters. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio, and the producer is Renee Moran. Assistance tonight has been provided this evening by Mr. Wally Derleth, Mr. Tim Snell, and Mr. Al Villarreal. Production of Health Matters has been made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Also by Gables at Spring Lake, Gamble's Guest Care Assisted Living Community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Next week, we will have a Thanksgiving show, which will be a pre-recorded show, which we will discuss nutrition and how to adopt and maintain a healthy diet. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us.